Can a survey change the future? Maybe this one can. Cannabis education is inconsistent at best and missing or misleading at worst. How can we make cannabis education better? What if we ask people who use or are thinking about using cannabis a bunch of questions? What if we ask pharmacists who could be teaching people about cannabis a bunch of questions? And then, what if the answers from those questions were used to help pharmacists teach people about cannabis better? Well, this is exactly what pharmacists as cannabis educators, or PACE, are doing. And PACE needs you to fill out a survey. PACE needs as many people as possible to fill out a survey. PACE needs you to fill out a survey on or before May 12th. This is a limited time offer for you to help change the future of cannabis education. To participate, go to promo.reefermed.ca. That's promo, P-R-O-M-O dot reefermed.ca.
Reefer Madness, the podcast, would like to acknowledge that we produce our shows on Treaty 2 territory and homeland of the Métis. We pay our respects to the First Nations and Métis ancestors of this land, and we reaffirm our relationships. And here we go.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast, with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk,
we're back.
You had a long, interesting conversation with an interesting guy.
Yes, I talked to Owen Smith, and to the point that we're making this into two episodes because it was such a fantastic discussion. Owen Smith is the man that sort of is the godfather of cannabis 2.0, I guess, in that he was taken to court for making medical cannabis edibles, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it's kind of funny, Trevor. I've been following Owen. He's been around the cannabis industry for pretty much ever, I guess, and now in this industry. But I've been following him on LinkedIn, and he's got some neat stories. And so I just contacted him and said, "Hey, man, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about medical cannabis and where we're at, and the government's review of the act, and." Let's have a chat. And he was very open. He said, "Let's do it." So we started the conversation. That was my intent. And he gets
and things happen so often in this wonderful thing we do. Things went sideways, a really interesting sideways.
Well, yeah, it's. I mean, how many times have I interviewed a guest and the thesis I'm after is not what I gather? And you'll hear in this conversation that Owen's talking and I'm not saying much. And at one point, he stops talking, and I said, no, carry on, man. This is a fantastic story. So we're splitting this up into two episodes, and the first half of the episode is the backstory behind him getting charged for making edibles that I was never intending to get. So this is, like, bonus.
Absolutely. And, yeah, so let's listen to this really good story, and We'll come back, and then we'll give you guys a sneak peek of part two. So let's listen to Owen and edibles and his sister and.
Okay, well, my name's Owen Smith. I'm a cannabis advocate in Canada since early 2000s. I'm best known for legalizing cannabis extracts, edibles, and oils through the Supreme Court of Canada. I've had many roles, responsibilities along the way.
Yeah, you basically challenged the government and created cannabis 2.0.
Yeah, they did. They call it 2.0.
So Owen, walk me through, how did that all start with you? Give me your sort of how it all started for you and how you became an advocate for medical cannabis.
Well, I'm from England. So in England, there's not a huge cannabis movement like there is in Canada. Much further behind, unfortunately. So when I came with my family in the 90s, we didn't have any knowledge or expectation really that I would become a cannabis advocate as an adult. It was only after my sister contracted cancer that my family really turned over to trying cannabis. I had, previous to this, had the benefit of meeting Ted Smith. Obviously no relation. Ted Smith is the founder of the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club, the oldest still running Compassion Club in Canada. And Ted has talking about the benefits of medical cannabis, specifically for cancer and for many other ailments at my college every Wednesday. We have a little smoke circle outside at 3:20. Then we go up to the university and have a 4:20 smoke circle and go downtown and have 7 o'clock smoke circle downtown. So every Wednesday there were constant sort of advocacy events that are happening and helped inform me. So when my sister was sick with cancer, we knew we could go and get some access to some products that she could use, edible cannabis. She smoked cannabis and used some topical. It was a skin cancer that she had, melanoma, just very aggressive. And she died within a year. But in the last few months of her life, after the doctors had given up on what treatments were available, and she tried cannabis, had restored her ability to eat, to sleep, and communicate and have social time with her family. They gave her, went out for dinner, just, you know, be able to hang out more. And that time, that last few months of her life where this had granted us our sort of ability to say goodbye is priceless. And I think at that point, I kind of saw the situation with what Ted was doing, and I offered to help if they would need a baker or whatever they had going on. I'd be happy to come down. Knew that they were breaking the law to do that, but also could see that the suffering for people is very real and very painful. And knowing how prevalent cancer is, there are many, many families who would have gone through a very similar experience to me and my family, who we could help to prevent some of that moving forward. And along the way, there was not just families with cancer, but children with epilepsy and many people with all spectrum of conditions who have amazing stories, who eventually testified for me in court for their use of the cannabis products, extracts and edibles and oils specifically.
So walk me through it. You are a baker by trade?
I was working at a local kitchen, breakfast kitchen. You know, I'd bake muffins and things like that before. So I was a young guy, and I think early 20s, and just out of college and stuff. And I went away for a bit and became a landscaper, and then just came back and happened to be that their baker had recently quit. And it was an opportunity, and I showed up at the right time, and they offered me the job.
So in the sense of putting this on a scale, was this before or after your sister's diagnosis?
This was after.
Okay, so your sister had cancer, she succumbed to that, and then she used cannabis for part of her care, and then you went into the cannabis medical industry after that.
That's right.
Okay, so here you are helping people, as the Victoria Buyers Club does, and we've interviewed Ted in the past, as you know. Walk me through that. That must have been something fearful when the police came busting through your door. Can you walk us through a little bit of that?
Well, I had thought about it before. I had imagined, you know, the consequences of what I was doing might run into this sort of scenario. So when I'd sit on my lunch breaks for who knows months, I would smoke a big joint, and for half an hour I'd be thinking about this and running it through my mind. What would I say? What would you want to say? You know, is having the knowledge that we were serious about fighting the law, it gives you the opportunity to, I guess, prepare. And Ted had previously been in the court number of times, establishing the right for dispensaries to operate. Also had brought up the arguments with edibles and extracts before, but they hadn't been answered by the courts because of legal technicalities. So he had explained some of this stuff in his Cannabis Digest articles, which is the VCBC's newsletter. And I had to understand, I was thinking about it. And so when it was a cold December morning, and it was the air cleaner that we have in the room, the big filter, it had become clogged. It had not been cleaned in a while. And the combination of lack of air filtration and wanting to keep the windows closed because of how cold it was outside, the smoke or the smell from the bakery went out into the apartment building, accompanied by the sound of my music, because I was a DJ at the time and playing shows on the weekends. I'd often make DJ sets in the week on the night and then listen to them during baking while I was working. And so the police had responded in part to a noise complaint, in part to a smell complaint. And the initial two police officers used a knock and talk strategy, which I was vulnerable to. And, they're not going to say, you have to let us in. And that could mean, if you listen to that, we have two meetings. It could mean that you're obliged to, you have to let them in. It's your responsibility to let them in by law, which is not. But it could also mean that you have to let them in, that you yourself have to permit their access, which is the truth. But, so I was a little confused, and I just sort of let them in. And immediately I told them, this is what I'm doing. It's a bakery for the Cannabis Buyers Club. Do you know Ted Smith? And the one cop who was of East Indian descent, I know Ted Smith. Sort of thing. It turned out that this man had previously stopped outside of the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club and hailed Ted to come outside onto the street, speak to him. Of course, Ted would happily jump at that opportunity and runs out to the street. And the guy only wanted to tell him about his recent trip to India, where his family still, they make cannabis pakoras, and he has a special recipe for the cannabis-infused pakoras. So this was the lead officer on the investigation. The first guy comes in, and so he's asking me some questions about the products. I knew already from Watermelon's case, which was an edible cannabis case before mine, that some of the defenses for that were that you can't tell that there's any cannabis in a cookie. Looking at it, how can you look and survey and tell me that there's a crime there? You can't. They have to take it away and test it and bring it back. So previously this sort of legal issue had come up, and the police officer asked me, if I ate one of these cookies right now, what would happen to me? Would I feel all silly, and would I get dizzy? But I have a great time all afternoon. and I was like, you know what? Those aren't for you. Let's be clear here. Those, you're not allowed to eat those. Those aren't for you. They're for medical patients, for people with serious conditions. And if you were to eat them, then they wouldn't get their medicine. And they need their medicine for their cancer pain, for their epileptic seizures, and for their ability to sleep at night. Perhaps you would find it hard to sleep at night knowing that you'd eaten one of these things. So it was my opportunity, as I had sort of practiced a little bit, sort of started laying into them. Do you know, I know you're doing your job, but do you know the consequences of what you're doing actually have real world effects? You know, those real world people out there tonight, this is going to be their experience because of what you do. You know, so try to approach their conscience just as a human being. And it was interesting. They just accepted it. And I offered to sit myself down because I'm about 6'2" and the cops were smaller than me. And I was talking down to them and I was feeling a little aggressive. So I was like, okay, I'll sit down. And that's he sort of asked me these questions a few more times and called in another officer. And the next officer who arrives sticks his head around the corner. And his name is David Bratzer. And this officer is a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I'd recently had David at the University of Victoria as part of our convention, our 10th annual cannabis convention at the university. And he spoke about the harms of prohibition. And so the poster was on the wall. And when the evidence went through and the police took all the pictures, that poster was part of the evidence. And there was a Victoria police officer as a third person on the case too. Seeing that, I'm like, that's two of three police officers I know who have cannabis sympathy, at least in their real life. So the other cops were, there's one in town here known as Lars. He's sort of chief of police at this time. And he'd had many run-ins with Ted in the past. And Ted had actually even challenged him to a boxing match at some point as raise funds for cops for cancer. So he came in and he called out, this is the first, I've been in lots of grow ops, but this is the first bay cop I've been in. It's sort of like, ha, 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 chuckle. And we liked that. So we had a file for all of the material and everything from the case, and we called it the bay cop. Thanks to Lars. The room was full of boxes. We were compiling a game, board game, at the same time as making cookies and stuff, a cannabis growing board game. And so it was just quite the scene in there with a crowd of police officers, boxes of board game parts for growing cannabis with cookies cooling on them and lozenges all rolled up like candies, caps in a cap filling tray, and butter melting on the stove, and lots of other oils in the fridge. And so later they would come back and seize much of those things. Two doors down was a member from the BCBC, and when they heard that and saw the police arrive, they called Ted at the club. And Ted and a couple of the staff come running over, because where I am in the apartment building is about two or three blocks from where Ted is. And I usually walk back with armfuls of baked goods through the city at the end of the day. And of course, nobody could tell. I'd often walk past police officers holding bags of cannabis cookies. Couldn't tell. But Ted had they come, and so they were outside the building. They didn't handcuff me, but they did read me my rights at a certain point and took me downtown. When we were leaving the apartment building, leaving the room, one of the other cops asked me who lives here, because I guess that was one of the things they wanted to know, like, whose apartment really is it? Was I going to hide that? And I just told him the very sick old woman, which was the truth, and that's sort of, it's just when you speak the truth to power in this situation, it's humbling, because it is just, it's a harsh reality that we live where this plant is illegal. It's just helping people. So they took me outside, and Ted and the other staff were outside. And Ted remembers the moment when I walked out, he said, the other police officers walked out with their heads down like this, and you walked out like this, no handcuffs. And I went and sat in the police car. And on the way to the police station, they're talking in the front seat. And they knew the part about you can't tell if there's cannabis by looking at cookies. And so they're like, what do we do? What is going to happen? And honestly, this is what I remember them saying. The one guy was like, well, they're just going to have to legalize it. It's just going to have to be legal now. And we got into the police basement and Victoria downtown and got out, and they're like, okay, we gotta put some handcuffs on you now, but understand, like, we've given you the rock star treatment, but we're gonna lead you into the cell area, then you have to be handcuffed. So we went into the interrogation room, and I spent the next 8 hours talking to different police officers, sometimes in twos, and they would ask me similar questions and in different orders to see if I could remember things like, you know, when did you go to college? How many years were you in college? Like, what town did you grow up in? So all asking me all this information, because they believed that I was somebody who I wasn't. My wallet was lost about a few weeks before this, doing other things, partying. I was partying on a mountain, raving on a mountain. I lost my wallet, and so I didn't have any ID. And so they were going through this they thought that I was somebody on the run, a fugitive, because I looked a little bit like somebody they were looking for. And so this was going on and on. And I had my phone call, and the guy said, you know, you don't have to tell him anything. It's like, all right, well, it just wasn't going anywhere until they brought out my student ID card, because which was the best piece of ID with a picture on it. But it was from when I was at college, and where I had a shaved face, it's kind of chubby, and I had short hair. And at this time I had long hair. I was like skinnier, and I had a big, big beard. And they were all laughing. They thought it was hilarious. And then one of the police officers came down the hall and happened to be an old friend of mine from high school. When I was younger, I played soccer, and me and a couple of friends, we formed a soccer team based on the idea that we all smoked weed. We called it the Blazers, because it's one of those words that means two things. You can blaze the herb, or you could be blazing fast, or, you know, you could wear blazers or whatever. So we had this secret cannabis soccer team, and this guy was the goalie on the soccer team.
I love it.
He saw me from outside, and he's like, comes in, he's like, and I wouldn't expect to see you in here. And I'm like, me either. I was doing anything wrong. They validated my identity through one of their own there. And about midnight, they let me out. I remember it being very cold. It was December, I say, and I wasn't dressed for the night because I'd been working in the day. So leaving the police station, I've been pretty cold. And the interrogation room is set up to be very uncomfortable. Very bright lights, audible hums, sort of an ugly room to be in for 8 hours. But got back to the club about midnight, and Ted Smith was still there, and a few of the other staff were still there, smoking joints, and gave me a hug and kind of helped calm me down a little bit, and gave me the day off work the next day so I could... and gave me back weed so I could sit at home and smoke and think about how awesome that just was.
So you obviously had to go through the provincial system, and you were found guilty of cooking cannabis, and you took it to the Supreme Court, and you won there.
That's right. 6 years.
6 years it took.
From that arrest until the Supreme Court. We did the province of BC in 2012. That was 4 weeks. We had scientists and patients testifying. We had the government bring their chief science officer, as well as a regulatory expert from Health Canada. And we duked it out, and science, I was on our side. You know, the weird denialism of prohibition, it just can't hold up against the arguments that have been established through science. And given that, you know, the situation was so ridiculous that people were allowed to have cannabis, dried herb, but not allowed to make anything with it. We had the examples of just like making a cup of tea, you know, You have cannabis in a tea bag. We have tea in a tea bag, and you put it in a pot and you pour water in it. Do you leave the tea in it? What's the point of leaving the tea bag in the tea? You know, what you're really trying to do is get a nice measured cup of tea. You know, you don't really want a strong, strong tea necessarily. But there was law at the time that you had to leave the tea bag in just in case the police came, and they needed to check that tea bag, make sure that the weight of it wasn't over. And that's bringing us back to that idea that they just couldn't enforce cannabis extracts and edibles because they couldn't visibly see the cannabis in it anymore. And so it was like, are these patients first or are these criminals first? You know, no, they're people first. You don't start them as criminals. The other one, which, I mean, there's a lot of science in there, but the other example that was given for the judge's benefit that helps to explain how extracting cannabis from the plant is not only makes sense to do that, but it happens anyway. It's just part of what's going on. It's present in a legal bag of cannabis. Once you've removed the cannabis and you're holding an empty packaging with trichomes on the inside, it's a silly sort of thing like this, but the golf ball on the tee was the other thing. So really the trichomes are produced in the reservoir at the top of the hair of the trichome. The materials needed to produce cannabinoids come up through the plant's roots and through the body of the plant and express out through the base of those trichome hairs, through the trichome to the base of that reservoir at the top. And there's a rosette of cells at the base of that reservoir, which do the final work of transforming those ingredients into the cannabinoids that then are suspended in this fluid with terpenes. And as if the wind blows or you knock up against it, it's sticky. It's sort of pulls from the body of the plant in a number of ways, liberates naturally from the plant. So that's sort of a central argument to them understanding that it not only makes sense, but there's no way getting around it.
Yeah. So, well, okay. So the provincial government obviously finds you guilty. And what was the technicality that the Supreme Court fell on that said, no, we're going to say you win the appeal? Because my understanding of the law, there had to be something in what happened in the provincial system that the Supreme Court to say you failed to prove X. So what was the point the Supreme Court gave you that said, go back home and cook your cookies?
The Court of Appeal. So after we'd won the constitutional challenge, and I had my charges dismissed at a hearing after that, we went to Vancouver about 18 months later or so to do Court of Appeal with three judges. And those three judges looked at the initial judge's ruling, and they decided 2-1 that we were in the right. So the two female judges were in agreement with the original trial judge, but the one other judge had questions in and around, I believe, legal standing. The idea that because I was not a legal medical marijuana patient, that I wouldn't have legal standing to challenge a law that doesn't necessarily affect me in terms of a medical cannabis thing, even though my freedom certainly was risked by this law in place. And we have a civil right to help those by the charter, to help those who we can see they have benefit, medical necessity to use something. So I believe we had the Section 7 standing. The judge believed that we didn't. But because he dissented, that gave the government automatic right to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. So that was part, the majority of what was discussed in the Supreme Court, which was only about 1 or 2 hours of time. And it was dismissed there. We had been supported in the Supreme Court by interveners, which are groups which see the arguments and align with the arguments and bring in other arguments or help to add to the arguments that we have made. And so we had legal experts there just really to hammer out that detail, and they were very happy to show up at the Supreme Court of Canada. You know, everything had flipped. When I started, it was, you know, us scrapping together getting our one lawyer versus the government bringing two really slick lawyers to come against us. At the end, it was pretty much just the government with one lawyer who had anything to contribute, but we had like 10 lawyers, with 9 of them being there of their own volition. Like, they were so happy to be a part of this. So we got to knock down that standing argument. As you know, corporations have been awarded standing in cases. So yeah, as a citizen, I had a standing.
That's amazing. See, I had it backwards. So you won the original provincial, you lost the appeal, you won the Supreme.
Well, we won the appeal 2-1.
Yeah, okay.
Because there was even that little question, then okay, the government could elevate it to the Supreme Court.
Okay, that's fantastic, man. Thank you. That was more of a story than I was expecting. My original goal with calling you was to say, as an expert of the medical cannabis field, because you are involved with it, you've taken the government to court over this, or you've been taken to court. We've got a few minutes left on the real subject I wanted to talk about. What's happening to the medical cannabis industry right now, in your opinion? And I'll just let you talk, mate. I'm just going to sit back.
There's some interesting advances related to my case that are ongoing. We have Pat Wernicke and Jerry Martin and another does have a case that's coming through that relates directly to mine and the limits that were put on edibles and extracts. These limits weren't established in the court, and they don't really make a lot of sense in the law. And when you currently, there's sort of a workaround because you can get concentrates legally. You know, you can get smokable concentrates legally, very, you know, high test stuff. And so, but you know, you can't get edibles or topicals with anything above 3%. So it's in this strange spot where if you wanted to get a high strength concentrate for an edible use legally, then you have to pretend that you're going to smoke it.
Right.
it's just, you know, this is they have to sort these things out still. But you can buy a syringe just like you used to be able to in the old days. Because for medical, I mean, when I was running dispensaries before it was legal, there was always a sense for those who have cancer that we are going to help you make sure you get that oil, get the honey oil that you're going to be eating. And it was just lacking in the legal system altogether. Like, how is the legal system even coming close to the social benefit and the social growth potential that we had when we were making sure we were taking care of people with cancer? You know, it was really the baseline, I thought, back in the day. And there was a lot of volunteer online promotion stuff. People would often talk about their cancer and their cannabis oil use. I'm very surprised you couldn't find that. But some companies have done the workaround where now you can sell a concentrate and people will have to meter it out themselves, unfortunately, because that is against what the government's intentions are when they, you know, want patients to have, with their regulations, have strict meter doses. Well, because they haven't sorted it out, patients are necessarily having to meter out their own using oils which have been made for smoking. Another part that's a problem with that is it was always a lower grade. If you eat it, you don't have to go through as much processing. So it could be made more affordable for those. I know there's a $40 price tag on that per gram concentrate honey oil you sort of get online. So there's lots of room for improvements. I'm just been recently introduced to a program called UTender. UTNDR. Check this out, UTender. I'm one of the people on there. So you can go to this site and you can sign up for a medical cannabis license. And then you can have somebody like me who will talk to you about what kind of cannabis that you're looking for. And they've sort of got a shop in within that. So they have doctors and medical staff who will review your medical documents, and they will, you know, if you want to grow cannabis, get your license to grow, but otherwise get your license to possess larger amounts or have it, you know, delivered to your house as part of the medical system. And so this is new, a new thing, which is nice to see people trying to innovate on the medical system. As with the Cannabis Act review, I just finished a campaign with the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club and Ted Smith to raise awareness about how the Cannabis Act review asked whether or not we need a medical program at all.
So Kirk, we have two of three cops think that Owen's a good guy. We have some other random cop at the station used to play soccer with them. One is, you know, heard to say, well, you know, maybe this stuff will just have to be legalized. So he certainly was not an unfriendly territory, even after the initial arrest.
Well, as I said to you in the start here, I did not know this was going in this direction. I didn't ask him. I didn't expect him to tell me this. And it was, I found it fascinating. And I just sat there going, no, keep talking. The best part of the story for me was when he's sitting in this police room for 8 hours, and a buddy of his walks by and goes, "Owen, what are you doing here?" It's like, isn't Victoria a small town? It's my hometown, right? Newlyweds and nearly deads, it always was Victoria. It's a much bigger city than it was when I was there, but it tells me that it's still a small community. The business community, the Chamber of Commerce, those who are doing, people know who you are, and it's a small community. I just thought that was a ridiculously wonderful story.
No, it was. And one of the things, because I can't be the only one, because of the last names, yes, Smith, Common, I kind of assumed that Owen was related to Ted. So I liked how early on he cleared that up, because he must get people like me all the time. And then just, you know, kind of a regular My Cannabis story that we've heard a lot, you know. His sister gets sick. They're learning cannabis might be helpful. He finds this Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club when this Ted Smith. And on Wednesdays, they do some smoke circles and he can get access to some product. And just kind of goes from there. So, you know, it's, I guess, like revolutionaries everywhere. He wasn't really getting into this to start a revolution. He just, you know, had a burning need for, you know, someone who's very close to him, and it's kind of gone from there.
He was trying to help people. End of statement.
Yeah.
And he stumbled into it, and by stumbling into the situation, he got lots of peer help. He got a lot of lawyer help. Obviously, the lawyers fell over to be part of his gig, and now here he is. So. Like, that went on for about a 30-minute discussion. I thought it was a great story. I didn't know that he actually won the provincial case. And then the government took it to appeal. And he won two out of the three. So the law was there all the way supporting him, all the way.
Yeah.
So.
No, and now let's tease the part two. So back to kind of your initial question, is the government of Canada is now reviewing cannabis legislation, and there's lots of interesting things in there, including what should happen to just kind of the medical system in general, and should it keep existing? I think that's a good teaser about why you should come back for part two.
Well, part two of Reefer Madness, the podcast. I'm Kirk Nyquist. I'm the registered nurse. We got to remember to introduce ourselves.
We do. I'm Trevor Schufelt. I'm the pharmacist. Come back for part two. It's completely different, but still excellent.
In the meantime, I'm going to throw on a little Peter Tosh.
Okay. No one's going to say no to that.
Well, time to blow this joint. Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermed.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next.
Woke up this morning with a funny, funny feeling, and that feeling was an unusual feeling. In my bones, yeah, it in my blood.
Fit for desire. have it in my toes, in my ankle, in my knees, up to my waist, under my ribs, across my shoulder, in my finger, up to my brain. Reggae, my life is
Well, they didn't handcuff me.
Oh, okay. So I'm not going to interrupt, man. Just carry on. We can always have another meeting another day. Just tell me the story. It's fantastic.